The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So it's very nice to be back here and see everybody coming for a Monday night. And in the spirit of Ajahn Chah's encouragement and teaching, he very much emphasized that the Dhamma is, it's a language of the heart. It's not a language, although there is a Dhamma language, obviously there's Pali language, which encompasses and is used to communicate the Dhamma, but the true teaching is a language of the heart. And so, I'm sitting here in the teacher's seat, waiting for some words to come out, but the words can only really kind of point you to what the Dhamma is, and the true teaching can only really reveal itself in your own heart and mind and through your own practice. So I might, hopefully there'll be something I say tonight, there might be something I say that will remind you of the truth that you already know. So we all inherently have the potential to be fully awakened, and we all get confused, or maybe we are confused, like most of the time, So it's like it's a process of finding our way back to our true nature. So we tend to think of the path as, I'm here, and the goal's over there, and I've got to get there, and I develop these strengths and I get rid of these things and then I'm going to get to where I want to get to. And it's true, we do need to develop strengths and we do need to give up certain aspects of unwholesome aspects of our minds, body, speech and mind. And we find ourselves right here where we always were. But we sort of forgot we were somewhere else in our mind, creating some sense of self, some story of who we are, who we're going to be, who we should be, who we shouldn't be. So these are all the stories that we create. And in believing those stories, we forget our true nature. And we all do them, So on our way here, as I often do, I was asking Sister Jayati. This is Sister Jayati, who also lives at Aloka Vihara. She's a 10-precept novice, and she's been in the robes for 7 years now. Is that right? Six going on seven. A little more than six. So I was asking her, what should I talk about tonight? And she said, why don't you talk about deeper renunciation? Oh, that's interesting. We didn't discuss what that means. So that's an interesting thing. And so I was during the meditation, I was sitting here thinking, okay, now a nun comes, or a couple of nuns come to this group, and they're going to talk about renunciation. And I was just kind of looking at you all and thinking, oh, probably that would be something like, oh no, I'm trying to talk about renunciation, we've got to give up all the things we want to do, all the lovely things we enjoy, and become really kind of austere and, But I was contemplating what that might mean, the deeper renunciation. So the Buddha definitely encourages renunciation, not just following our sense desires. And I was speaking in the meditation about, the mind being one of the sense bases, and we can continuously fill and stimulate our minds with interesting things. It's very enjoyable and it feels very harmless, but it's a kind of distraction because we miss the beauty of what we truly are. It's like something we're putting on top of what we already are. And of course, you know, all the other kinds of sense desire that we're very familiar with. That the certainly society here offers various means to fulfill. It's very easy to, if you've got a little bit of money, it's very easy to fulfill sense desires of all kinds here. And so, you know, there's the six senses, the ear, the ears, eyes, nose, tongue, body and mind. And we can enjoy the experiences that come through these sense bases. And also we can experience, you know, difficult feelings through the same sense bases. But I don't really want to talk about the renunciation of the senses as such, but renunciation of the attachment to self. So one of the ways I've heard renunciation described, which I really appreciate, is renunciation is giving up something good. It's giving up something that feels good in order to make the space for something even better. So it's not giving up and then feeling like, ugh, nothing. But it's giving up because you know that even though this feels kind of good, or it feels safe, or I kind of like it, if I give it up, there's something greater that can be received that I can't receive as long as I'm holding on to this. So that works for any level of renunciation. But the really important one, or deep, subtle renunciation, is the renunciation of attachment to me and mine. So it's insidious, you know. It's something that comes up in everything that we do. Our views, our being right, our possessions, our feelings. You know, it comes in many, many ways. I'm sure if we just kind of open up the floor, we could get about 60, maybe 100 or so different aspects of what we consider me and mine. And there's a certain sense of safety in that. It feels safe. We feel like we have to defend our position, you know. I don't want to be a doormat, people walking all over me. This is my view, this is my position, and I'm going to stand by that. I'm going to defend that. And, you know, there are times when it's appropriate to do that, and yet one has to know that it is just that. It is just a position. And even if I am right, the person that I'm disagreeing with might also be right. In fact, I think quite often it is the case that, you know, I'm right, and I'm sure I'm right. And the person I'm having an argument with is also equally sure that they are right. And they probably are, from their perspective. But we're looking from different perspectives. We have maybe different values, different ways of understanding, different expectations. So, you know, there's a certain sense of solidity or a pseudo strength that comes from holding a position of being right and being you know, standing behind my position. But it's also suffering in that, you know. There's conflict in that. There's separation, alienation. There's a smallness to that. So even maybe we can't immediately step back from that position, maybe feel what it feels like. Feel the kind of, there's a certain armoring that happens over the heart. That's my experience anyway. Maybe it's not for you, but I experience a certain hardening over the heart, protecting, so that I can make my view known. And then if I recognize that, it's like, you know, this isn't how I want to live. I don't actually want to live as a separate person who's getting their point across and maybe feels, you know, maybe it's kind of a lonely experience. So to come back to that feeling of the hardness, the hardening of the heart that happens when we hold on to a view, and to feel that and invite it to soften. Invite it to soften and open. And maybe then to go to that person and have a conversation and hear their point of view and take it in and recognize, maybe there's some truth in that. Maybe it doesn't fit with my worldview, but it's not wrong necessarily. And break down, like let go of that attachment to me and my view. So, first of all, we've got to notice that we're doing it, and then we have to notice what it feels like and what effect it's having on ourselves and others. And then kind of step down from that position and have the courage to step into a space of unknowing, where there's going to be maybe some dialogue, maybe it's going to be a bit painful, and it's a little bit risky maybe, but it's if you hold it in the right way, it's a means to breaking down that solid sense of self. And you might wonder, why would anybody want to break down that solid sense of self? It feels good, it feels safe, it feels, it's what we're all told to do anyways, from the moment we're out of the womb. Be somebody, be unique, be special, be the best. But it's alienating, it's lonely, it creates that separate self in this ever unfolding universe. And the Buddha is pointing very clearly to the attachment and identification with this experience, whatever it may be, the sights, the sounds, the smells, the tastes, the feelings, the thoughts, moods, as being a solid me or mine. That this is the source of suffering. This is the source of our dukkha. So, and when we contemplate that, it just starts to question, well, why am I doing this again and again? And we do the same thing, the same response, the same pattern, and it takes us to the same place. And then we come and meditate and, try to connect with our true nature, and then we go back and then we do it again, and then we do it again. So to really look at the ways, the patterning of this particular self, the particular way that each of us here, each person here manifests, the particular defenses, the particular desires, fears, even reasoning. So it's not to say you shouldn't use reason, or you shouldn't have desire, you shouldn't feel fear, but it's about getting to know it, getting to know the way this particular one that is you keeps creating yourself. And for me, obviously the same, the way this particular one keeps creating herself. And then seeing that it can, that there's the arising, the kind of positioning and creating and defending of this me, and then there are the times when it starts to break down, in a good way. I mean, you can obviously there's the breakdowns which are not so good, or that or maybe sometimes they are actually, but they just don't feel like they are. But then there's. There's the really, really big ones that get into the really, really big ones. But there's the little breakdowns. In fact, Ajahn Chah, he said about in monastic life, he said unless you have at least two emotional breakdowns, you're not really, you know, like kind of not just crying, but like really big kind of breakdowns. You're not really practicing well. So, you know, it's not about trying to be a perfect person, but it's about allowing this process to unfold and recognizing when we're defending and holding tightly and trying to get more and more to fill this experience of me, to make it feel whole. We all do it. I mean, I do all of those in a day, you know, numerous times. And then, but it's knowing it. It's recognizing it. And once we know it, and we can be honest and recognize that tendency, that need, or that fear, or that positioning that we take, then we can start to meet it with more kind of interest, actually, curiosity, and start to investigate. Well, what would it be like if I didn't, or if I go back and apologize, or I just give up that one thing, not because it's holy to give things up, but because I want to know what does it feel like. Can I bear the feeling of giving up that one thing? Maybe I can't. Then I know that I can't actually do that right now. I can't bear to give that up right now. But I'm aware of my need, and I'll maybe see if I can give it up next time that desire arises. Just as an experiment to see what happens. Because it's all about feeling. It's all about the feelings that arise here in this mind, in this heart-mind, and how we relate to those feelings. Because it's very, very simple, but we're so quick to attach and identify with the feelings that are here that we don't even see that they are just feelings. So that feeling of desire, of I really need that, I really need to have that, it's a feeling. It starts here in the heart-mind. It's a feeling, a craving. And sometimes it's so strong we can't just be with it. Or sometimes we tell ourselves we can't just be with it. But if we can even just recognize this is a feeling that is arising now, it wasn't here maybe 20 minutes ago, and maybe if I sit and wait a while, it'll pass on its own. You know, have an see what happens. And as we continue to get to know all of these arisings of self that go on numerous times in a day and in a night, in the sleep it's still going on often, then partly we get to see that the play of it all, the pattern, the particular pattern that it plays out, we can start to see where it was conditioned. Certain things that were conditioned in that way, and so it arises like this now. And we can shape it to some degree, so we can start to steer our tendencies in a more wholesome direction. But it isn't about, you know, the practice isn't about becoming a really good, lovely, perfect person. It's almost like the goodness and the loveliness is a side effect of the practice. It happens not because you're trying to create a good person, make yourself into a good person, but because you're seeing the suffering of following unwholesome mind states, unwholesome speech, unwholesome actions. You see directly the suffering that arises from that for yourself and for others, and you feel it, and you don't want to keep doing it. The feeling of it is the incentive to not keep on and on again and again doing that same thing. And the feeling of joy that comes through doing something good. So we just heard last night about, it was apparently a TED talk of some experiments that were done on happiness, actually. I think it's called something like You Can Buy Happiness, something like that. And this experiment was done where they gave quite a large number of people. They gave some $5, some $20, you know, basically. And then they divided those people in half. So in each half they had the same amount. Some had five, some had 20, some had five, some had 20. And then one half they said, go out and buy something for yourself with that money. And to the other half they said, go out and find a way of giving that money away. And then when everybody had done what they needed to do, they'd come back and they'd talk about what they did, the ones who bought what they'd bought for themselves, and how happy did that make you on a scale of 1 to 10? And it's like, you know, maybe happy for a little moment but not for very long, you know. And then they would ask the people who'd given the money away, and their experience was, wow, I felt really good, I felt really happy, and the person I gave it to, they felt happy too. So, you know, you can buy happiness. So it's through doing these things that we see the result and we feel the result, and then that we're steered in a direction because we recognise for ourselves it feels good. It's like, you know, we're mendicants. We don't have any money at all of our own, and. Since shortly after we moved to Alokavihara, we heard about Buddhist Global Relief, these walks that we do each year. And even though we were just kind of starting here, we had virtually nothing ourselves, just at the very beginnings, and Buddhist Global Relief was starting, and we felt like this is a really, really good thing. It's got really good ethics. It's got a very broad understanding of the causes of poverty and food insecurity, and it really meets at the place that this needs to be met, and it's for everyone. It's not just for Buddhists, it's not just in Buddhist countries, it's for people in many different countries of the world who need it, including this country. And so, you know, one of the things we do each year is we go out and we walk to feed the hungry, if people sponsor us, you know, if people give donations. But we walk anyway, and then we let people know about it, and then also maybe they let their communities know about it, and then we walk, and through that people are fed, or they have better farming implements so they can make better food, or they learn about the importance of breastfeeding, say women in Africa, and then their children are more healthy, and then they have a better life, or helping girls stay in school who would otherwise end up in brothels. Sadly, this is very strong in Theravada countries, interestingly enough. So helping girls stay in school, or helping girls get out of brothels and into work. So like self-employed, learning a skill. So it's not just about giving a bag of food, but it's about helping people get back on their feet. And to do that brings a lot of joy. Even when you haven't got anything yourself much, it brings a lot of joy. So it's through doing these things that we see the potential. And it's the greatest joy is it comes through selfless acts. So you can get a lot of joy from doing something because it's a good thing to do and you feel good about it. And you can tell people that, hey, I did that and I feel really good. And that is good too. It's lovely, and it can inspire other people too. But there's something about just coming back to that essential experience of oneness, of non-separation, that happens when you're giving to another, not because you feel sorry for them, poor thing, you know, but because they're your sister, they're your brother, they're your child, they're your mother, essentially. Because they are you. Essentially, so there's a beauty in that giving, because you're giving what you know, what each of us needs, what is common to humanity. So, you know, giving up the self, giving up the attachment and identification to me and mine, I'd really like to invite you to look and investigate in your lives, you know, where that arises, the many places that arises. And not with a judgment, not with like, oh, I shouldn't be doing that, oh, I should be doing that again, because that's just another self arising, that's just another attachment and identification. But to recognize our true nature, which is ultimately it's empty, it's compassionate, it's changing all the time, it's responsive. And to see how the times that, you know, the countless times that gets lost in a contraction of wanting or of fear or of aversion or of judgment or of rationalization. That's another, I don't mean you should be irrational, but you know, we can also just go up into the intellect and lose contact with the direct experience of being. So just to recognize the times when that's happening and take an interest, like investigate and see where is that attachment, where is that holding, and can I release the grip? Can I ease the grip around that? And even if you can't do it straight away, you know, it's almost like you're calling your own bluff. You know, you're starting to see where it's happening, you know, where that happens again and again. And even you might have to just keep seeing it again and again, then, oh, I've done it again. No, I can't step down from my position. No, I am right. You know, and what does that feel like? And could the other person be right too? Is it possible? You know, just keep asking those questions. And it starts to break down in a healthy way, the separate, solid me and mine. And it's, you know, it's often said that it's a courageous act. You know, it takes some courage. Because it feels much safer to hold to an identity. And it can be very scary, the thought, well, who am I going to be if I don't hold my position? Then what? So only you can find out the answer to that question. But you won't be a little pool of jelly on the floor, that's for sure. You'll probably be much more present and responsive and clear than you were when you were coming from a place of me and mine. So there might be just little moments where you see it. And that's great. That's already wonderful. And you just keep investigating, keep allowing those little moments to open. And don't judge the rest of the times when it's not happening. Just know it. Okay, so I'm going to offer that tonight and just leave a few minutes for questions. Nice t-shirt.
Thank you. I notice whenever I'm on retreat or in these kinds of situations where the talk is about no self, I get really anxious.
Uh-huh. Like,
no, it's not, and I know part of it is that when I catch glimpses of not being able to find self and kind of getting that truth.
Mm-hmm.
The experience isn't peace, it's panic.
Uh-huh.
And part of that, and another aspect of that, is I can feel my mind trying to grasp, what does that even mean? And then I get into this loop of, okay, but what is the being that is asking that question? And it just gets really circular. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what is your advice, both with the anxiety around the concept of no self and the mind trying to grasp conceptually what that means.
Mm, yeah.
Because I think that's part of the panic, is not being able to figure out what that actually is, the no self.
Right. No, I think it's very, even as I was speaking about it, I could feel that little anxiety feeling in my own heart. I think it's very, you know, it's a natural response of the ego, because the ego is being threatened with imminent death. So it's very natural. And, you know, and it's interesting you speak about that the mind is wanting to make to understand conceptually what does that mean? What am I going to be then, you know? So this is the basic kind of misunderstanding, because the thinking mind can only work in a dualistic way. It cannot function. It has to be this and other, me and other, time based and so on. That's how thinking mind works. And if we try to work out intellectually what am I going to be then if I'm not all of these things that I think I am, it is scary. So it's not about thinking about it. So again, it's like I was speaking in the meditation, moving away from the thinking. If you can allow yourself to move, to drop down from the thinking mind into the heart, say, before you bring up too strongly the concept of no self, because that brings up a lot of anxiety. So then you're going to be with a lot of anxiety, which is unpleasant, and you don't want to be there. But just in an ordinary time, allow your consciousness, allow your awareness to drop down into the heart space, the chitta here, and feel what's going on here. And in meditation, you know, we're learning to be present with simple things like the breath, knowing feelings arising and ceasing. And, you know, we tend to think like, oh yeah, my feelings. Yeah, this is my feeling, it's like this, and it's going away and it's changed. But there's always this like, yeah, and it's mine going on. But that's just the story. So if you took away the story of it's mine, what's happening? Same thing, actually. It's all the same stuff going on. There's feelings arising, there's responses, there's thoughts, there's movements towards and away from things. It's all the same, but you're not having a story going on. So just to recognize the reality of the changing nature of this, of what we are. So there's the kind of obvious things of like, you know, once you were just a few cells in your mother's womb, and then you're a little baby, and then, you know, a few things in between, and then, you know, toddler, and then a child, and then a teenager, and then an adult, and then, you know, going through these different things, and your face has changed, your hair has changed, your body has changed. There's that way, you can look at it in that way. And then there's the more immediate, and it's carrying on, the change is continuing, you know. The hair will get grey at some point, maybe start falling out, and you know, the body gets more tired and achy, and it's just that's what bodies do. And then there's the more immediate change of the breath. I think the breath is a wonderful teacher of no self, actually. The breath, which is constantly changing. It's not, you can't pin it down at any moment. You can't really call it mine. You know, we're all sitting here together breathing, sharing it all. It's not, none of it's really belonging to anybody, and we, you know, 3 minutes without any breath, you're gone, you're dead. So things like that, just like questioning the truth of identifying with what's actually going on, because what's actually going on doesn't necessarily change. It's just the relationship to it changes. So it becomes nature doing what nature does, rather than me. And you know, we all have different minds. So some people here may be very intellectual, some people artistic, some people scientific. We all have our different minds. That's not going to go away. That's a particular manifestation that the mind does. And it will, you know, we can cultivate certain things, but you don't have to be afraid that you're going to become a vegetable or anything. But it's just allowing it to be nature rather than this tight holding. And so I like to use this analogy of in terms of letting go. You know, we think about letting go as you know, if I let go, then I've got nothing, and then ah. But it, you know, we can also, or I want to let go, throw it away. You know, I don't want it, or I'm afraid to let go, so I'm going to hold on. But there can be letting go like that, where it's all still here. The five khandhas are still going on, the thoughts, the feelings, all of that is still going on. But the awareness is just holding it like that. It's just knowing it all, and it's changing all the time. So just playing with that experience of what that feels like and what that feels like. And maybe at some point there'll be that. Who knows? Okay. Yes, gentleman at the back.
Yeah, hello. I liked what you said about the connection with money and happiness and that example and so forth. So I just have a comment on that. Most of us aren't in a position to go over to Darfur or wherever there's need and so forth, but there are a lot of charities out there that supports some really good work. One of the confusing things about the charities is there are a lot of unscrupulous ones out there. So yeah. I just want to put out there that there are a couple of websites that check out charities that you can pick out. And one of them is by the Better Business Bureau called the Wise Giving Guide. And another one's called Charity Navigator.
Thank you.
And you can go through them and see which one's pass and which ones fail and so forth.
Thank you, that's very important. Great. Charity Navigator. So everybody else is clear. Yes. There's a mic somewhere.
Hi, I'm Lindsay.
Hi, Lindsay.
So my question is, I find that giving isn't necessarily always my hardest thing to deal with, but giving too much sometimes. And I was wondering if you had any advice on how to give to people that you might view as selfish, unfortunately. Or who, when you try and give, it just, I feel like sometimes, in particular, like a brother or sister, someone younger, who just, I try and have patience in giving, but the more I do it and get the same reaction, the more discouraged I feel, and the more I feel like I'm being taken advantage of, or, you know, it just, I start to get more upset with the situation. Right. So, any advice?
I'm not sure if I can give you the right advice, but I mean, when it's true giving, it is joyful. And so it sounds like it's not a natural giving, but there's an expectation, maybe. And it could be that they have an expectation from you that you give a certain amount, or it could be that you have an expectation that they respond to your giving in a certain way. It could be, I don't know which one it is, or it could be both. But there's something going on there that isn't open-hearted and isn't flowing. And so you don't have to give, you know. You could just try saying, okay, for this time I'm going to just change the way I'm doing things. Because, you know, I was speaking about patterns like this, because we all do that. We have patterns of ways we relate in the world, and then they keep bringing us to the same place. So if we don't want to be where they take us, then we've got to start to look at, how can I do this differently if I want to end up somewhere else? So you could just try, you know, saying, okay, for this time I'm not going to... I mean, I don't know, this. It's a bit difficult for me just because I don't really know the situation and if they might be totally dependent on you, I don't know. But just to say, okay, for now, for this period of time, I'm not going to be doing this and you need to find another way or whatever it is. And, you know, you might all feel relieved, actually, because it might be that you're locked into some sort of dependent relationship where they feel like they've got to be dependent on you, and then you feel you've got to support them, and and that you might all be happier by just breaking that pattern. But it does take a bit of, it takes a little bit of courage to change those things. And it can also be that, you know, we see ourselves as the giver, and there's a certain, there's a risk in giving that up. You know, like, who am I going to be if I'm not in that position? There can be that too. So it's looking at all of those things. But definitely, when you're giving, when you're really giving and not obliged because you have to, it's joyful. I wonder if I probably should finish now, shouldn't I? It's 9 o'clock. Can I go a couple of minutes over time? I just wonder whether you can say anything about the poems, because it's such a... Maybe I can just introduce it then, because I think you're going to be modest now. Because one of the things we started doing at Aloka Vihara is once a month... putting together a breakfast to give to homeless people in downtown San Francisco. And Sister Jayati has basically kind of, you know, it was an idea that she's really run with. And she gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning, starts baking bread, and because she can cook, she's a novice, and bakes amazing bread and cakes and various stuff. That it's all from things that people have given us. She lets people know there's going to be a homeless breakfast. People bring flour, yeast, fruit, various things, and she makes this amazing, beautiful bread and then slices it into hundreds of slices and makes breakfast to give out to people. I think there was something like 200 last time. Yesterday, was it yesterday? Isn't it? 200 yesterday were given out. So I was just, if you don't,
about the how it feels. Does it feel like an obligation?
No.
Put it on your ear. You don't need this.
I may not speak for that. Just
hold it.
Okay.
Oh.
not really prepared. I'm really tired because I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, and then Sunday morning we went out and a kind of team of supporters that sort of different people each time have kind of congregated, and yeah, that people just really inspired to get involved in this very, you know. It's kind of this, I do it really with this an awareness that we're just doing it once a month. We're not really necessarily transforming in a big way the lives of those people, and yet there's something about in that moment of just direct connection, because we kind of just go out onto the streets and sort of hunt the homeless, basically, with these breakfasts. And there's, you know, sometimes at the beginning of the interaction there's not much eye contact and it's a little bit... But there's always a kind of moment where there's a really direct meeting point. And I kind of feel at that point, for me there's a sort of sense of self just kind of dissolves, actually. And any sense of me giving to somebody in need sort of disappears. And there's really just a sense of, just something... just very direct, and it's not even... Sometimes people say there's this sense of, well, I do it because I have this feeling that it could be me. And in that moment, I feel like it is me. You know, this person in front of me is, you know, there isn't a me and you. It's just who we are, you know, and it's, very uplifting experience. So, I think I would recommend... I think, you know, it's very touched by what you said about the charities, because I think... You know, that's a very good thing, and also if you're going to give to a charity, to know that, you know, it's they're working well. But I would also really encourage to actually maybe find something very direct within your own lives where you can actually have that sense of really kind of hands-on in some way, and just whatever you can come up with, really, to, because it's something, it's a great learning in just having that direct contact. So recommend it.
So a little bit over time, but just to take a moment to to recollect the goodness of your practice, of your intention, of your speech and actions. So not to focus on the things that you missed or did wrong, but to really bring to mind the wholesome intentions that brought you here tonight, and probably are motivating many things in the day, in your life. And just let your heart be filled with that goodness. Even if you can only find a little bit, don't worry. And then share that, however abundant or little it may be, share that for the benefit of all beings, those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile. May all beings receive the blessings of my life.